Across the Pacifica Network and over 50 community radio stations around the country, this is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, January 2, 2003. I'm Deepa Fernandez. Brazil's new left-wing president is inaugurated, but what are the real chances for change in Latin America's most populous country? The Zapatistas break a two-year period of silence, we'll go to Chiapas. And UN sanctions on Iraq are also devastating Iraq's neighbor, Turkey. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Today, Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez said the slow-moving oil industry will be up and running normally in 45 days. This after more than a month of disruptions that Chavez supporters say were caused by those who want to sabotage his rule and the Venezuelan economy. Enacted yesterday were 49 new reforms. Critics claim prove Chavez is a dictator, but his supporters say show his desire to encourage economic opportunity for all people in his country. Two of the controversial provisions are a law that restricts large-scale commercial fishing near the Venezuelan coast and a redistribution of land to peasants and city dwellers that includes a cap on the amount of land one person can own. Free Speech Radio News correspondent William Camacaro explains the third most vital and controversial law.
Even though the Venezuelan oil company was nationalized in the late 1970s, the management and control of the company remain in the hands of a few rich families. Hydrocarbon law passed by Chavez put the control of oil company under government administration. The problem of the oil regime was that 80% of the profit of the company stay in the hands of these few families, and only 20% of the profit was given back to the state. Many of these families are right now in the head of the opposition.
That was Free Speech Radio News correspondent William Camacaro. A leading human rights lawyer from the Niger Delta, now in detention, has gone on a hunger strike in an ongoing campaign for political and economic autonomy for the oil-rich, cash-starved region. Sam Olakoya reports from Lagos.
The human rights lawyer, Mr. Festus Keyamo, was arrested in his Lagos office last Sunday. Since his arrest, no one has been allowed access to him. Mr. Keyamo, however, sent out a letter to the media indicating that he has gone on hunger strike. He said he's been detained without adequate food, clothing, and medication. He says security men are questioning him about his campaign for political and economic autonomy for the Niger Delta region. Tension continues to grow in the area, with local communities complaining that oil revenue is shared almost exclusively between the Nigerian government and Western oil companies operating in the area. Troops are being deployed to the area following anger caused by President Olusegun Obasanjo's refusal to sign a bill that will give the communities a share of offshore oil revenue. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos, Nigeria.
Six Palestinians, including three boys, an infant, and an Israeli, have been killed since the beginning of the new year. The Israeli army killed the three boys, aged 13, 14, and 16, after claiming that they were trying to infiltrate the settlement of Eli Sinai in North Gaza to carry out an attack. Later, an Israeli army official admitted that the victims carried no arms or bombs, but one had a big knife. And an Israeli human rights group is again raising the charge that the Israeli government is breaking international law by indefinitely detaining over 1,000 Palestinians without charge or any other form of due process. Israeli officials say the increase in detainees is directly related to the increase in terrorist activities. In the meantime, Israeli troops were on the move throughout the Palestinian territories. 26 Palestinians were arrested and three injured during the raids. This report was made possible by Awad Dudavis in Ramallah. U.S. State Department officials have accused two major aerospace companies of illegally providing satellite and rocket technology to China that they say could be used for intercontinental missiles, despite U.S. plans to have space-based weapons by 2004. Ellen Ratner reports from D.C.
The formal complaint against Hughes Electronics Corporation and Boeing Satellite Systems has outlined 123 violations of the Arms Control Export Act and the International Traffic in Arms Regulations. Hughes officials said that in the mid-1990s, the Commerce Department's lax regulations lawfully allowed the company more give and take. The State Department says that the information provided by the companies is very similar to anti-ballistic missile technology. That is technology that China needed for successful space and weapon launches. The U.S.'s new plan of missile defense, named Son of Star Wars, calls for 10 interceptor rockets to be functional by 2004. China is expected to launch a spacecraft with crew in the second half of this year. If successful in their manned flight, China would gain a foothold and thereby increase their intercontinental missile capabilities. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Ellen Ratner.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Today has been the first day of a new dawn for Brazil, with the Lula administration officially taking power yesterday. In a ceremony attended by Cuban President Fidel Castro, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, and Argentinian President Duhalde, yesterday Brazil's new president, left-wing Workers' Party leader Lula da Silva, was inaugurated in the Brazilian capital, Brasilia.
If at the end of my government, every Brazilian can have three meals, three square meals a day, breakfast, lunch and supper, then I feel I will have fulfilled my mission in life.
BBC World Service sound there of President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva speaking at his inauguration yesterday. Brazilians have high expectations for Lula's term in office, for which he's been promising some radical social and economic change. Giancarlo Summa was Lula's campaign press secretary and is now coordinating press for the World Social Forum.
The mood in Brazil can be resumed in just one word, hope. 76% of the Brazilians, according to a poll, they hope that President Lula will be able to make a great government and will be able to change deeply the Brazilian society and the Brazilian reality. Brazil is a very big country, a very rich country in a way, but a very one of the worst wealth distribution in the world. Of the 175 million inhabitants here in Brazil, more than 50 million live below the poverty line. So for them, the presence of Lula could mean the possibility for the first time in the Brazilian history to live a decent life.
Now, Lula had made many promises during his campaign. He alluded to alleviating hunger in his speech. Which do you think are the parts of his campaign promises that Brazilians will want him to implement first?
Lula himself repeated yesterday that if he will be able, during the 4 years of his term, to allow all Brazilians to have three meals a day, to at least to resolve this problem, the problem of the hunger in Brazil, he will be considering accomplishing this mission, the mission of his life.
Do you think, though, Lula is obviously up against the world's financial institutions as well? Is there a chance that he might not be able to meet some of his bigger promises because of pressure from the international community?
This is exactly the biggest bet. So to be able to accomplish what he promised and at the same time not to break the ties with the international financial institutions, mainly the IMF and, well, the international financial system. The pressures are huge. The common sense of the world market says that this government should keep cutting the social expenses all the time, and much to the contrary, Lula says that in Brazil and his government must demonstrate that it's possible to expand the social spending and at the same time to have a very sound fiscal policy.
Just finally, President Lula da Silva has gotten off on his first day to a breakfast meeting with President Hugo Chavez of Venezuela. Yesterday, his inauguration was attended by Fidel Castro. He's definitely meeting with some of the world's more pariah leaders. Do you think the Brazilian people see this as a positive thing?
Definitely, yes. the political crisis in Venezuela, here in Brazil, is not being interpreted the way that possibly it is in the United States. Everybody knows that Hugo Chavez was elected democratically, and that what's going on now is a very political protest, and in a way, it's not a very democratic one. As the special envoy of President Lula to Venezuela said, well, what they are doing is quite preparing a coup against Venezuela, I mean the opposition. So, no, the Brazilians don't think that Hugo Chavez is a very dangerous person. Much to the contrary, there's quite sympathy toward Venezuela.
Giancarlo Summa, President Lula's campaign press secretary, he is now coordinating press for the World Social Forum. The Iraqi government lashed out at the UN Security Council for adopting a US-backed resolution that tightens controls on imports to Iraq, saying the measure would inflict, quote, deliberate damage and harm to our people. The resolution passed Monday by a 13-0 vote, with Russia and Syria abstaining, puts new limits on purchases of communications equipment and antibiotics. The Bush administration claims the antibiotics would be used by the Iraqi military in a war. Human rights groups are sharply critical of the US-UN sanctions on Iraq. The United Nations Humanitarian Agency estimates that sanctions kill 5,000 children every month. And, as Aaron Glantz reports from the Turkish-Iraqi border, the sanctions are also having a devastating effect on the economy of Iraq's northern neighbour.
Children play in an open field in a village a few yards from the barbed wire fence that separates Turkey from northern Iraq. Despite their appearances, the children have a tremendous weight on their shoulders. The Habur Gate between Turkey and Iraq used to be a vibrant commercial corridor for diesel fuel. Turkish truck drivers used to drive into northern Iraq in the morning and return with fuel in the afternoon. But for 2 years, the border gate has been closed to regular truck traffic. Marcin is 12. He stands in the middle of a truck graveyard. He dropped out of school when he was 10 and became a shoe shiner after his father lost his truck. Marcin provides his family's only income.
I have to work to make money for my family. In the morning, I wake up and go outside at 7 o'clock, and I work until 8 o'clock at night. During this period, I can earn just $1 or $2 a day. It's very hard and boring every day.
Across southeastern Turkey, more than 50,000 trucks sit idle, rusting on the side of the road. Almost everyone here is unemployed. Mehmet Cantas is one of the few who still has a job.
It was a fact that so many Kurdish people, not only in Turkey but also northern Iraq, have made some money. It was a fact, but nowadays it is hard times for Kurdish people in both areas, and the war means the situation will get worse.
A new newspaper poll released today in Turkey shows more than 9 in 10 Turks oppose a U.S. war on Iraq. 12-year-old Marcin has a message for the American people.
If someone is listening to me now, I want them to know that I oppose the war. It will hurt us even more here. I want peace.
The chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, Richard Myers, is on his way to the Turkish capital Ankara to help prepare the way for the war. This week, the Turkish government made a formal proposal to Washington. In exchange for its support of the war on Iraq, the Turkish state wants 10% of Iraq's oil revenues. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz at the Habur Gate between Turkey and northern Iraq.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez. For an archive of today's newscast or previous FSRN stories, go to www.fsrn.org. That's www.fsrn.org. The indigenous-led Zapatista movement of southern Mexico broke a 2-year period of silence yesterday with a march and rally that commemorated the 9th anniversary of the Zapatista uprising in Chiapas. The rally was held on the day that farm tariffs between Mexico and the US were lifted under the North American Free Trade Agreement, a move that small farmers in Mexico worry will flood their market and devastate their livelihood. Jenka Sodenberg reports from Chiapas, Mexico.
They came from all directions, north, south, east, west, women, men, children, elders, wearing ski masks and brandishing machetes. The Zapatistas converged yesterday on the city of San Cristobal de las Casas in Chiapas, Mexico, in a peaceful but militant march that ended with a rally and bonfire in the central square. The march officially ended a silence that the Zapatistas have held for nearly 2 years, since their last meeting with the government in Mexico City in April of 2001. During the rally, seven members of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, Comandancia, took to a stage before a crowd of 25 to 30,000 supporters. They carried no arms but their machetes and pledged support for the struggles of indigenous people in Chiapas and throughout the world, including support for the indigenous people currently threatened with forced removal from the Montes Azules region of Chiapas. The statements also included harsh indictments of the Mexican government and its current policies. Comandante Esther.
Al señor Fox, solo te digo que el pueblo mexicano...
President Fox, I say to you that the Mexican people are disillusioned with all of your tricks. You go traveling abroad in foreign countries, saying that there is peace in Mexico and that you have solved the indigenous problem. I say to you, where is the peace? It isn't in Montes Azules, where you're conducting forced resettlements. What you want to do is to provoke a war so that you can sell the mountains of Montes Azules to foreign businesses.
The Zapatistas who gathered yesterday in San Cristobal were commemorating the 9th anniversary of their armed uprising on January 1, 1994, when the Zapatista Army of National Liberation took over San Cristobal, the commercial capital of Chiapas, in southern Mexico, and a number of other municipalities and towns in the area. Since the Zapatistas began peace talks with the government, the Zapatista Army has maintained a ceasefire and have fired no shots since the 94 uprising. The Mexican government, on the other hand, has established more than 250 military bases in the small state of Chiapas, approximately the size of South Carolina, sent members of the Mexican military to train in counterinsurgency techniques at the infamous School of the Americas in Columbus, Georgia, and has been implicated in the funding and arming of paramilitary groups that have carried out numerous assassinations, kidnappings, and massacres of Zapatistas and their supporters in the 9 years since the Zapatista movement was made public. Comandante Tacho.
Pero hasta que hubo alguien que una madrugada de aquel primero de enero de 1994...
It wasn't until in the early morning on the 1st of January in 1994 that someone raised their head to say, Ya basta, enough already. I am somebody. I have a name, and that name is the Zapatista Army of National Liberation.
Representatives of the Zapatistas are planning to attend a gathering in the Canary Islands off the coast of Spain in April, which they consider part of the internationalization of their movement. Comandante Mister.
Por eso le decimos a los poderosos del mundo.
We say to the powerful of the world that if they unite to globalize death, then we will globalize the rebellion for liberty.
Comandante David.
Al cumplir 9 años de nuestro levantamiento en armas y después de romper el silencio que tuvimos casi 2 años.
Today, after 9 years of our armed uprising and after breaking 2 years of silence, the time has come to speak again and to say the truth, that we, the indigenous Zapatistas, didn't rise up in arms to ask for charity, or that the government can continue mocking us as it tries to do, and to offer us lies and crumbs to buy our support.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Jenka Soderberg in Chiapas, Mexico.
With cities throughout the West sprawling out of control, Portland, Oregon's metro government beat their year-end deadline for completing a 5-year ritual of evaluating the urban growth boundary. The boundaries are Oregon's way of keeping sprawl in check. The latest expansion has proven to be the largest by far in state history. But what that means for affordable housing and sprawl is still up for debate. Rob Manning reports from Portland.
Inside the boundary, city. Outside the boundary, farmland. It's a simple concept, but the laws, rules, goals, and plans that go into decisions on whether to move the urban growth boundary and in what direction are far from simple. The decision begins with population projections, and when predicting how many people are going to live around Portland in 20 years, it's little more than guesswork. A few tenths of a percent can make the difference between expanding the boundary or not. By adopting a 1.6% growth rate rather than 1.3%, Portland went from accommodating growth within the current boundary to the largest expansion in state history. Metro Councilor Bill Atherton found that decision inappropriate.
The preponderance of the evidence in this record was what is happening on the ground in the real world. And the evidence that we heard today is that a lower growth rate is prudent and called for, and the evidence is supported.
But Atherton was joined by only one of his six fellow councillors, and his last-ditch attempt to put the brakes on the expansion was ignored. The expansion is moving almost entirely into the semi-rural town of Damascus, a community complete with forested buttes, clear creeks, and picturesque views of Mount Hood. Damascus residents lashed out at the Metro Council at a public hearing before the decision. Local resident John Ferguson.
I wonder if the people who are making the decisions about transforming this land really know what they're about to destroy. Have you actually gotten out and walked across this land? Walked up in the woods, seen the springs that come out of these hillsides that supply the Clackamas River with drinking water? Or is all you've seen of Damascus a view out of a car window and some lines on a map?
But Damascus has no representative government. The county is willing to see Damascus developed because they want to see job creation. Open space defenders prefer Damascus be urbanized so they can keep expansion off of the better farmland on Portland's west side. But to hear some developers and consultants tell it, Metro Council may have pulled a fast one. Some home builders believe that by drawing the boundary to include an area that will be difficult and expensive to serve, Metro is actually limiting growth despite the enormous size on paper. Chris Eaton is a consultant who worked on a plan to move urbanization into areas of Washington County that have better existing roads and infrastructure than Damascus.
I'm afraid that the Damascus expansion is in fact really a no-growth expansion, or it's a very limited growth expansion. In fact, it's not going to provide housing over the long term, over the 20-year period. Not because Metro's flawed in their analysis, but because it's going to be very expensive to serve.
If the plan is, in fact, a no-growth or limited-growth expansion, the upside is that Portland will curtail sprawl for a while longer. However, the ugly downside is that cost of housing will likely go up. Recent studies from the Brookings Institute have shown that growth management, when used to limit housing, can drive up real estate prices. That kind of trend puts farm and open space advocates at odds with affordable housing supporters. Clackamas County Commissioner Mike Jordan admits regional leaders have a long way to go to understand affordable housing.
We do the land pretty good. We're understanding the economy better. But boy, that social piece, we don't get it very well. And what really concerns me is, you know, I've been to a million of these tables in the last few years on land use planning. You don't see many low-income people at those tables.
Oregon's land use laws do have goals for affordable housing, but little enforcement has been done. In the Portland metro area, it's further complicated by the existence of the Metro Council, a regional government that only has so much power to get counties and cities to meet affordable housing goals. Soon enough, this question will be put on the back burner for Metro, because before long, they'll be looking to add industrial land to the boundary. As Councillor Susan McLean said at a recent meeting, it's going to get even tougher. In Portland, this is Rob Manning for Free Speech Radio News.
Last year marked a turning point in Argentinian history, with the extreme government cutbacks to jobs and social care, coupled with the deaths of many activists protesting in the streets. With the social crisis escalating, this past weekend again saw protesters take to the streets. Sebastian Hacha and Pablo Biolo have more from Buenos Aires.
Today marks a year since my brother was killed, and I have been missing him a lot. For me, he was more than my brother. He was more like part of my life, part of my history. What I demand is justice for my family, for me, and for all. Not only for my brother, but for all the boys who were killed that day and those that were wounded, I demand justice.
It has just been a year of popular rebellion that changed forever the history of Argentina. The wounds still continue to open. Thousands of mothers and sisters, as here, still clamor for justice. Thousands of children are teetering between life and death. Since last year, the government had cut jobs, the public budget and social care. Started the protest, as Oscar explains, a work of the current classes and combative had not been resolved.
We are saying that this government follows the same politics as that of De La Rúa. The government of Duhalde continues applying the adjustment, continues paying the external debt, advances hunger, and increases unemployment.
In response to these government policies during the year, the spontaneous protest changed form and gradually organized. On December 20, exactly 1 year after the first massive and spontaneous protest, nearly 100,000 people came from all over the country to march to the president's residence at Plaza de Mayo in Buenos Aires. Néstor Pitrola, one of the leaders of the National Bloc Picketeer, explains how the crisis evolved.
This situation has snowballed, and today, along with the popular assemblies, the occupied factories, the bank savers, we are the great ones of the Plaza de Mayo and in other main squares of the country every Thursday and Friday. The federal march has truly created a great balance and political perspective in the people.
Concluded the year, neighbors of the popular assemblies gaining momentum by occupying factories and organizing movements of unemployed workers. For Julio, an assemblyman of the city of La Plata,
it's been a year since the events of December 20th, and we continue now with the same spirit. We are trying to deepen all the growth that we have obtained and continue organizing to create a space of work, not only in the neighborhood, but in the city.
The organized social movements that have emerged during this last year are now taking on basic social functions the Argentinian government no longer provides, such as community dining rooms and workers maintaining factories closed by its owners. Mobilized from the north of the Argentina, Ernesto, an employed worker of the group Stand Up Neighborhoods, explained.
We are maintaining soup kitchens in the province of Chaco. We know that they are only a band-aid, that they are not going to solve the problems of the country because the problems of the country are deep. We want a country in which we can find work with education, and we want final solutions.
Organizers and participants in these movements, which have emerged all within the span of 1 year, say they illustrate the type of country they strive to rebuild. Again, Ernesto explains.
It's a lie that we're a poor country. That cannot be, with all the wealth that we have. A country that can feed 1 million people also has little boys dying of undernourishment. It seems that there is looting, but not the looting that they want to make the people see who go to the supermarkets to ask for food. The looting is being made by the great capitalists, the political thieves, who leave people in dire situations. The solution then passes through the political issues here. That we need is another government, a government of people that has the participation of people, in which people take part in the important decisions of the country.
Although this year of unrest in Argentina and the future of the country is uncertain, what Argentinians who took to the street say is that the collective scream was born during the demonstration, that will not go away until stability returns to the nation. That all must leave, that is not either one alone. From Free Speech Radio News, we are Sebastian Acher and Pablo Moreno from Buenos Aires, Argentina.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.